255.
Excellent.
Okay, you guys are rolling.
We're in. Seth, back on the podcast for round two.
I am?
You're back. This is round
two. Why wasn't I informed?
What do you mean?
Okay.
You don't remember round one?
I do. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. By the way, I couldn't help feel a little bit. So my producer, Chris, is here. He's running around setting everything up. He's doing an amazing job.
Yes, he is.
And I said to you, you know, we'll set up in 30 minutes. So as he's setting up, I can't help feel like Frederick Taylor at the Ford company with a stopwatch, checking the time, saying, are we running on time? Are we ahead of schedule? What's going on? And he was doing a great job. But what's the point here? Because I don't want to be Frederick Taylor checking my stopwatch all the time and making sure we're running on time. But I have to make sure that we respect your time and we're timely. So where's the balance? How could we have done this setup in a different way? Or how do you feel we did on the setup?
Frederick Taylor, with Henry Ford, invented the modern age. Henry Ford is famous for the cars. Frederick Taylor is famous for the stopwatch. What happened was Henry Ford said, I can use machines to make a car. People don't understand how much cheaper the Model T was. It was less than half the price of any other car. It was a fine car for what you could buy, but it was half the price. And he did it with machines. But Frederick Taylor said, you know who we're paying the most to is the people who run the machines. Let's treat them like a resource. Let's imagine that the humans are a machine too. And if we can measure every single second of their day, we can make the cars faster. And the term jerking someone around came from the Ford plant, because when you watched someone there, it looked like someone with invisible wires was jerking people from hither and yon. Okay. So if we're going to live in an age where time is money, where productivity is measured, where we make promises and keep them when it comes time to budget calendar, sooner or later, we have to say there's a stopwatch. We have to be able to say, this project is not worth doing if it takes 8 years. It is worth doing if it takes 2 weeks. UPS can't charge you to deliver a package whenever they get around to it. So my argument is, if you're going to win, if you're going to deliver value, if you're going to help by bringing human creativity and insight to the fore, you can't use a stopwatch for that part. You have to use a stopwatch for all the other parts. So if someone is doing a job where I can write down every step, that job is a stopwatch job. If on the other hand, someone is using judgment and I'm going to succeed because their judgment is better judgment, I maybe need to use a calendar, not a stopwatch.
So I do my newsletter, and every week I track several metrics across it, including the open rate. But I think to myself oftentimes, like when my open rate is down, I don't really know what to do with that information because I don't think I would change the content.
Mm-hmm.
And when my open rate is up, I feel like I'm a king and I'm a content god, but I don't really know what I'm doing that way. Is that a valuable metric to track? Or when you're doing work like that, what should you be tracking?
Okay, so the first thing is you are a content god. Everyone knows
that. Everyone knows it.
You should not measure your open rates.
Yeah.
I was the first person to measure open rates.
Yeah.
I invented email marketing a very long time ago, and we went to great lengths to measure our open rate. The problem is all an open rate tells you is, was the subject line good? Because no one knows what's in it until they open it. So the best open rate we ever got was a subject line that says, how many Microsoft engineers does it take to screw in a light bulb? That got the best open rate of anything we ever did. But it's not, you can't maintain it. It's not steady because you have to keep doing one gimmick after another. And the problem with gimmicks is it's a race to the bottom. So I haven't measured my blog traffic or my open rate in more than 10 years. I haven't read one Amazon review either. It doesn't make your work better. It just gives you something to worry about.
Is there a balance though where like, that gives you something to worry about, but let's say you were building a company, you want investors, or I feel like sometimes these metrics, you have to know these. Like, I feel like some people might not have the luxury of not being able to not know these metrics.
These are false metrics.
Yeah.
It's super important to measure useful metrics. You, like someone said to me a couple of weeks ago, I met this guy up in Canada, and a friend said, you should talk to Seth because he does social stuff. And the guy had 400,000 followers on TikTok. And I don't use TikTok. And the guy like poo-pooed me because I'm this old bald guy. And he said, yeah, I do this TikTok thing. And then he came back to me the next day and he said, there are millions of references to you on TikTok. I said, I had no idea. But that is a useful metric. If other people are talking about your newsletter, if other people are forwarding your newsletter, that metric is something you can do something about. That metric is aligned with your goal. And so what we've gotten trapped in is measuring easy stuff as opposed to measuring useful stuff. People who like you don't like you. People who call themselves your friends aren't your friends. But there are lots of really useful metrics online and off that we can use to find out if we're on the right path.
Speaking of people referencing you, I wanted to ask you this, which is, I read a book last year and I felt like every single chapter, I won't say the author, every single chapter, the author was referencing your work and your books. And I sort of had this thought, which was, can this guy come up with his own ideas? Now, on one hand, I can imagine it's very flattering to constantly have yourself come up in other people's books. But on the other hand, I can also imagine you thinking, I come up with this stuff and package it, come up with your own work. You know, do you ever feel like that? Or are you just always flattered when people reference you in books?
You know when I like it even more? When they steal my ideas and don't reference me.
But do you really feel that way? Yeah. Like, yeah, you really feel that way?
Yeah. There's a guy who wrote an entire book that was lifted from one of my books. I will not say anything more about it. The whole book. And I wasn't even in the acknowledgments. Fine with me.
And how did you find out about it? Because you read the book and you said, and you thought
that someone was trying to promote the book and wanted me to mention it and whatever, whatever. So I read it. And I was like, this seems familiar. This seems familiar. And my ego is big enough that I looked in the acknowledgments and I'm not there. Fine. Great. Because the purpose of the work is, that's why I don't understand the people who want to sue AI who are creators. Because if a human being reads a whole bunch of books or listens to a whole bunch of music and then makes a song that references something you did, they're not stealing from you. They're part of the culture. Right? That's why we make things in the culture, to make the culture what it becomes. So I think when you say, no, that baseline belongs to me and no one's allowed to use it, I don't buy that.
Do you think your peers feel the same way, or who knows?
I had an argument with someone at dinner 2 nights ago with someone who does not feel that way. And I said to him, but in the last 5 minutes, I've heard you reference 8 things that other people in the culture came up with, and you didn't give them credit or money.
Yeah.
Like, you can't have it both ways. That Lewis Hyde's book, Free as Air, he wrote The Gift, which is one of the greatest nonfiction books of all time. Free as Air is a little harder slog, but it argues we invented copyright law for one reason, not to treat creators fairly. That's not what it's for. What it's for is to encourage new creators to show up because it's good for all of us. If we have enough creators, then copyright law is doing fine. And so we have more songs being produced than ever before. We have more books being written than ever before. We don't need a more rigorous copyright regime.
Okay, fair enough. So the new book, The Song Significance, which I really loved. I felt like I've been thinking about a lot of these ideas. I also think you've been spending a little bit too much time with the bees, Seth. You've explained a lot, but walk us through the bees to catch the audience up if they haven't read the book yet. Why are we looking at the song of increase, and how did that inspire the song of significance?
I don't think it's possible to spend too much time with the bees.
Okay. I just started reading her book. Jacqueline's book. I just started a couple nights ago.
She's
inspired by you. And the book is mind blowing.
Yes.
I'm 3/4 of the way through it probably.
Yeah. She's a character.
Yeah.
Okay. So a bee is not an organism the way we think of an organism. It is part of an organism. The bee colony is like the organism, and each bee is the neuron, the brain, part of the brain, a tiny little piece of it. And what we learn from bee colonies is very useful lessons about organizing without an organizer, leading without a leader. No one's managing. And yet the colony thrives and survives. It figures out how to work together. Just like there's someone in Nashville, there's someone in LA, and there's someone in Minneapolis, and they're all making music and they've never met and no one is telling them what to do. But somehow a dance is going on that will lead to the next thing in our culture. And the deeper I went into the bees and learned about the song of increase and then coined the phrase the song of significance, it helped me think about the fact that we have been indoctrinated into thinking that our job is to do what we're told, and that the purpose of our culture is to help make money. And in fact, the purpose of capitalism is to enable our culture, not the other way around. So if we are lucky, if we are privileged, if we have a roof over our heads and enough to eat, what should we do tomorrow? It seems to me that cutting corners, hurting people, abusing the system so we can make an extra $5 isn't the point. And Adam Smith agrees with me, and so do lots of people who thought about the way we would industrialize for hundreds of years. There's just a few people who say, no, the only purpose is to race to the bottom, shortcut all you can, and it doesn't matter that there's a 12-year-old in that meat processing facility. If I can get away with it, I should do it. I don't buy that.
But the bees gave you that idea?
Okay, so the bees, I don't want to get too bee wonky, but...
No, get bee wonky with me, Seth.
Here we go.
It's just you and me here.
At the end of May in the Northern Hemisphere,
yeah,
if the winter has gone pretty well, the hive will survive. But there's almost no honey left because they actually make honey so they have something to eat in February and March. And in that moment, the council maidens, who are the bees that have the most influence in the hive, will have a meeting and they will decide a couple of things. They will decide that the hive has a chance to sing the song of increase, and they will instruct the queen to lay and fertilize a new queen egg. The queen is not in charge of the hive. The queen lays 800 eggs a day, but fertilizes almost none of them. And what will happen is the queen, they'll build a vertical egg chamber. The queen will lay and fertilize that egg, but there can only be one queen in a hive. So now the clock starts ticking. They'll instruct all the worker bees, called maidens by Jacqueline, to collect as much pollen as they can. And what happens within 3 weeks, all the honey is replenished. All the honey is back to the way it used to be. It's full. And then, based on the weather report, 12,000 bees will leave the hive in a 10-minute period of time and all go to a tree 100 feet away, leaving behind all the babies, the baby queen, and all the honey. They'll just leave and never return. That's the song of increase. And so what happens is now you've got this tight ball of bees in this tree. They have to stay in a tight ball to maintain their body temperature. And the clock is ticking. They only have 72 hours to find a new place to live. Now, it's worth noting that except for the queen, who they brought with them, every other bee is less than 3 weeks old. None of the bees have ever done this before. They are wired to be in community to figure this out. Then they will anoint some of the bees as scouts. The scouts will cover a 30 square mile area, checking for a new place to live. And here's what's so many cool things. So then each scout will come back and do a dance in front of the hive. The dance shows how excited they are about what they found and exactly in to the meter and to the compass direction where that place is. And the hive will send two or three bees to check on the good ones. But remember, there's 12,000 of them. No bee sees all the potential ones. Then they vote. And there's no...
How does Jacqueline know this? I mean,
this isn't just Jacqueline. This is
everyone.
There's this guy, Thomas. I just forgot his last name. I can tell you how he did the science. The science is really cool. They will have a vote, and there's no election denying. There's a real vote, and it's always unanimous.
They don't recount. There's none of that.
It's unanimous. And then, as a group, all the bees leave, surrounding the queen, and at 5-10 miles an hour, they just fly directly to the new hive and move in. They just do it.
Yeah.
And then they start over and build a brand new colony right there. And when we think about this activity, seen from a really big distance, this isn't that different than a group of people in Columbus, Ohio, deciding to move somewhere and then building a thriving new community. It's not that different than the Mormons ending up in Salt Lake City, except we tend to narrate these things as one person in charge figured it all out. It's not really what happens.
And that was the inspiration for the book. If you never came across this, would you have not written this book, or who knows?
I had no desire to write a book. I wasn't working on a book. I had no book in mind.
Yeah.
And I saw the brutality of billionaires mistreating people, firing disabled folks on purpose for fun. I saw how many people of a generation that's heartbroken about climate are quitting their jobs or shifting from this thing to the other. I saw the end of the industrial age as we know it. I saw the end of the music business, the Hollywood movie business, one business after another. I saw the birth of AI. All of these things are in the same direction, a brutality that says it's more important to keep industry going than it is to prize humanity. So that was the hole in my heart. And what the bees did was they helped me see I had something to say.
I love the bees, man. It's all about the bees. I feel like in the music industry, I'm always shocked, and this is a gross generalization, and not to pick on anyone, but I always find that I find these people who work at labels or agencies or wherever, and the music industry was built by entrepreneurs and pirates and settlers and, you know, crooks and crazy people. And I often find that when I'm around these people, they are so timid and they are so uptight to try to do anything super creative. And this is a gross generalization, but they don't have freedom to do anything really exciting, really interesting. They're so in line. And I find them that many of them are not that inspiring. How do you think, if you're working at a major label, how do you tap into that energy, which is what actually makes it all exciting?
So it begins with a simple sentence: when in doubt, look for the fear. And the thing is, being a creative at any level in the whole organization is scary, because what if you're wrong? And so Decca famously turned down the Beatles. And so every record label famously turned down rap. And we could go down a very long list. Just the idea of, quote, a major label is a flag. It says, for the kind of person that would like to go to meetings more than they would like to put themselves on the line, this is a job for you. Because what you get is a business card and a suit, but you and lots of meetings to go to, but you don't get is direct responsibility for the next thing. So that's why almost every idea in music comes from the edges, not from the center. Because once you're in the center, even, you know, when you're Crosby, Stills, and Nash or Stevie Wonder, if you're in the center for too long, suddenly it's hard to act like you're at the edges again. That's why Neil Young is such a weird exception.
Yeah.
Because he keeps intentionally burning things down so you can go back to an edge. And the suits are working in a business that has no formula. They like to believe they have a formula. So a friend of mine ran two of the biggest record labels of all time. And I said to him, how do you know if you're going to have a hit song? He said, oh, the secret's easy. You need good writing. I said, how do you know if it's good writing? He said, because it made a hit song. And like, nobody knows anything. That's clearly the way it's approached. So the record industry is dead. It has been dying for the last 10 years. It's dead. Music is not dead. There is more music listened to by more people more often than ever before. But the industry, sorry, I knew that was going to happen. So I was going to get up and unplug
it. Is that the tea machine?
It's the tea machine.
The tea machine is the song of the tea.
That's the song of the tea.
There's
a way to turn it off, but every time I have to unplug it, I have to start over again. All right, it's almost done.
What a thrill.
So the music industry was based on scarcity of spectrum and scarcity of vinyl. Scarcity meaning only some songs get played by Casey Kasem, not all of them. And only some songs are available in the store, not all of them. So those two pieces of scarcity are assets if you own them. And we got rid of both of them. There is no scarcity of shelf space. Every record ever recorded available to anyone who wants to hear it anytime they want. And there is no scarcity of substrate because there they are. Just click and you can listen. So in the face of the long tail, everything that supported the industry is gone. Same thing for the book industry where I grew up, is the big book publishers have no clue what to do. A big book used to have a laydown of 25,000 copies, meaning someone like me would come out with a book, 25,000 copies would go to bookstores in the first week. Now, typically, it's 200. Not 200,000, 200 copies.
Is what gets sent out to the bookstores.
Right, because Amazon takes 50, and they're half the industry right there. So, and if it sells, they buy more. That changes so many of the calculations that we decided we're going to be around forever. So the next breakthrough in publishing isn't going to come from Penguin, and the next breakthrough in music is not going to come from Universal or whoever is in charge of music these days. So and movies, completely toast, again, because you don't have a finite number of movie theaters, you have an infinite number of movie theaters. So if you want to be a creative in any of those spaces, You have to take responsibility. You cannot be in a job where you take responsibility at a major label, because major labels are about avoiding responsibility and just hoping it lasts long enough for you to retire. So it's going to come from the edges. It's going to come from somebody who says, I'm going to buy back my masters. I'm going to do distribution a whole different way. I'm going to own different kinds of relationships. Here we go. And I think that's thrilling. But if you're working as a semi-junior person at a semi-major label, I think you might be fibbing to yourself.
And I've heard you say that oftentimes you might have more responsibility or you might have more ability to do something than you think. But if you really don't, you should quit because you can't get tomorrow back or you can't get today back. I've heard you say that. Is the reality is that there is some amazing art coming out of major labels, and every now and then something will get through and you'll say, oh my God, that's an incredible artist. They found someone great. They did something great. So if that's you as a junior person in a major label, what should you actually be doing?
Okay, well, if I sounded like I was saying major labels and major book publishers and major Hollywood publishers, directors, producers aren't making amazing stuff, that's not what I meant to say.
Right, okay, fair, yeah.
There's always going to be something interesting coming out of there. But who made it interesting? Was it the A&R person?
Or the creator. Right?
Or was it the creator? So John Hammond is off the charts. John Hammond, who did
Bob Dylan,
Benny Goodman, Aretha Franklin,
yeah,
right? And I mean, it's a pretty wide range. That's a great—
What's his deal? Because you always say it's luck, and then you can point to people who just had, you know, success after success after success. You go, that guy was not lucky. He had good years.
Well, okay, so I think John Hammond's thing was he came from a lot of status and privilege, so he knew he didn't have to put up with people who said no to him.
Right.
He took his tiny advantage, which he had, of Benny Goodman. And like Neil Young, he kept saying, I'm going back to the edges. I'm going to risk my job to go sign this Bob Dylan guy or this Bruce Springsteen guy over and over and over again. Mitch Miller famously was the head of music, I can't remember where, Columbia, 1958, 1959, on the record, I Hate Rock and Roll. He didn't want to go anywhere near an edge. And so Mitch Miller is remembered mostly as the person who invented reverb, not as somebody who had good ears. He had great ears. So did John Hammond. The difference is John Hammond had ears and guts. And what good is it to be in a major label if you're not doing something that takes guts, right? Coming out with the eighth collection of AC/DC, we don't need you to do that.
We have them.
Yeah.
We have the records. So take guts. That's the secret.
I think that's your job if you're... And I have been a suit. When I was in the software business, I had people come to my office and say, I want to make this piece of software. And my job was to say, is this uncomfortable enough to be worth my time at the same time that I can sell it to my boss? If I can make both of those things happen, that's something I want to do.
Is it a problem that their business model is to sign 10 acts and hope that one of them breaks through and that pays for the rest? Or is that just the reality of the metrics?
I don't think that they acknowledge that that's their business model. That if you want to have a portfolio approach, I blogged about this a couple months ago. A portfolio approach does not mean I have 10 things that are really similar and I hope one of them works. That's not a portfolio approach. That's an ego-driven thing of I know what works. I'm going to try 10 times. A portfolio approach is I have 10 things that are as different from each other as I could possibly make them. One of them is going to work. That is how VCs make their living. That is how brilliant Hollywood producers make their living, is one day they're doing this thing, which is ends up being Thelma and Louise, and the next day they do this thing, which ends up being a superhero movie. What do they have in common? They don't have anything in common. That's their job.
Is it worrisome that today, if you want to be a great artist in the music industry, you probably have to also be a great content creator, and being a great musician and being a great content creator don't always go in hand? Joni Mitchell would probably not have been great on TikTok. Would have been a shame if we never heard her music.
Right.
Is that some, I mean, there's always been gatekeepers. Like if you think about it, you had to have a great video for MTV, otherwise you probably wouldn't be seen then. But now it feels like it's really extreme. So if you're an artist and you're not a great content creator, but if you're an amazing artist, are you totally screwed in this version of the music industry?
Okay, so this is a really important point, and I'm glad we're highlighting it. The problem isn't that there are multiple jobs to do. There always have been. The problem is that the long tail makes every organization thinner. So in Herbie Hancock's autobiography, he talks about how the Rocket video came to be. And his entire contribution was thinking that these two people he met could make the video. That was it. That's all he had to do. That when we say we have a label here, you go make a song and we're going to build all this stuff around it, we're letting the person who made the music go back to making the music. They can grumble about all the photo shoots and all the sellout stuff they have to do. But in general, there's a lot of people who work to publish. But when the world is thinner and it's just you and a couple other people, yeah, you're going to have to spend way more of your time promoting than you would have had to in the old days. I mean, remember J.D. Salinger, a recluse who lived in a cabin. How is it that so many people read Catcher in the Rye? It's not just because it was a good book. It's because there were dozens of people who made it successful. In my world, most of the authors, if you don't make it work, it's not going to work. The publisher's not going to do it for you. And if you're a musician today and you're hoping that a label's going to pick you, assign 10 really kind and hardworking people who will get your vibe and then multiply it to the world, you're going to be waiting a long time. And, you know, I was just listening to a podcast about Hootie and the Blowfish, and that record was one of the two best-selling albums of the entire 1990s.
Sold more than any Taylor Swift record.
Oh, by a factor of many times.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that Darius didn't make the video and that Darius didn't plan the tour. That wasn't his job. His job was to run Hootie and the Blowfish.
Isn't that the bummer, though, that today you're expected to be a great artist and to be the content creator?
Of course it's a bummer, but what are we going to do about it?
What can you do about it?
Yeah.
But if you want to have that career, then you have to be the content creator.
Or go hire one. But you're going to need money to do that.
Yeah.
Right? We made a trade. We said, you can have any record you want, anytime you want to listen to. But in exchange, the chances that a musician will have private jet money are going down to zero. Because we got rid of the short head in exchange for the long tail, which means that other than a couple aggregators, there are very few people who are going to make a really big profit in the music business going forward.
Makes sense. I did an episode of my podcast a couple months ago, and I did all this prep and I interviewed this guest. And in the middle of the conversation, I go, you know, this is not working out. The questions that I thought were going to be great were not great. I was losing my confidence. Maybe the guest was in a bad mood. I go, this is not a good episode. I listened back, confirmed, not a great episode. I put the episode out. And a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, calls me a couple days later and goes, I just listened to that episode. What was with that episode? I felt like you guys were not on the same page. It was a mess. And I go, yeah, I don't know. The episode's still out to this day. It's not a great episode. And I thought to myself that the reason I put it out is because I feel like I have this commitment to my audience, which is consistency and also quality. And in that moment, I decided to go the consistency route, knowing it wasn't a great quality episode. Are those two good values to have? Is quality more important than consistency? Should I lean the other direction?
This is such a great question.
How do you value these two?
Everyone who's listening wants to know which episode it was.
But I will not say what episode it is. You can probably go listen and find out.
So words matter here, okay? Quality doesn't mean what people think it does. If you think about Louis Vuitton, or an Hermes bag or stuff like that, those aren't quality, that's luxury. Luxury means costs a lot of money and it's worth more because it costs more. A different definition of quality is that it meets spec. So a Lexus is regularly ranked the highest quality car in the world, but if you look at it with an electron microscope, every part is defective. It doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to meet spec. What did you promise? So in your case, when you're saying the word quality, I think what you're meaning is the idea that it's as pleasing, memorable, interesting as the standard you have set for what's worth listening to. Make sense?
Yeah.
But you decided it was a little junky and I'm going to ship junk because the second part is I promise that every week there's going to be an episode. Does that make sense?
Right.
So that's not consistency. That's keeping a promise. And different organizations have different promises.
Which part is not
consistent? The word I need to keep my promise is different than consistency.
Right.
Because what you can promise if you go to like Noma for dinner in Copenhagen is not that it's going to be the same dishes every night. It's just that it's going to be damn interesting.
Right.
So they need to serve clunkers because that's part of the promise. That's not the same as the word consistency, which is what you want from McDonald's every single time. It's mediocre plus one, and it's consistent. So the challenge, and it's interesting, you started the podcast with this idea of stopwatches. You're making a promise, and that promise permits you to make a promise to your advertiser, which makes a promise to your listeners, which lets you do this work professionally. Professionals show up when they don't feel like it, and they keep their promises. That's what makes you a professional. So how to work around this? Well, it's probably occurred to you, you need to have a few episodes in the box.
In the can, right. So that in this case, I did it.
Right, because then you get to say, once a year, I take the worst episode I do and I delete it. Suddenly, your average is going to go up because you've bought yourself that ability. So in the case of my blog, I haven't missed a day in 8,000 or so days. That's the promise. But I don't write it at 4 o'clock in the morning, right? Because if I get the flu, I'm going to have to break my promise. So I write it ahead of time, and then I read it the night before just to make sure that I'm happy with it. That gives me the ability to write multiple ones a day, to delete ones I don't like, to get back to the creative part of me, not the publisher part of me. And if you're feeling torn by these things, it's because you're wearing both hats. You're the creator and you're the publisher. And what the creator needs to say to the publisher is, you need to build some slack into the system. And that's what musicians need to be able to say to their A&R people, which is, I know you want an album from me next month. I think you made a promise that I was going to deliver one next month. I didn't. I need 4 more months to make this magical. Do you want something magical or do you want something that's going to lower the average? And building up a buffer is a really useful way to do that.
And is the buffer literally just simply having more episodes in the can? Like that would be the buffer?
Well, for you, but for a record label, the buffer is we're going to build enough slack in the system that we're not going to keep going back to our hit artists and milking them dry because then they won't be hit artists anymore. We're going to embrace scarcity. We're only going to do X number of concerts. You know, when you think about the history of the Dead, the year, there were a couple of years that almost did them in. And they were because they did too much touring. And the reason they did too much touring was they had hundreds of people on staff because they had so much equipment, because they had such a big touring apparatus that they had to go do one more thing to pay for the machine. Well, that was their fault because they were also their publisher. And what they should have done is said, we're going to build an amphitheater in Northern California, and we're not going to go on the road at all. And if people want to come to us for a year, come here.
Yeah.
We're not going to tour at all for a year because guess what? People are going to be talking about the Dead 50 years from now, and they don't care that we had to schlep all the way to one more concert while we were strung out on drugs. They just care that we burnt out too soon or we had a horrible period, right? Well, let's take a breath and say, scarcity is our friend. We don't have to be on the Miles Davis, Bob Dylan schedule in order to be the artist we seek to be.
And do you think having, you know, in the example of a podcast episode out that maybe isn't the quality that you hold yourself to, does that damage the brand in a sense, or does it not really matter and it's worth leaving up?
I love podcasts. I listen to them all the time.
Yeah.
I happen to think that an uneven podcast is better because it's more interesting. So there's a music podcast I listen to, and it was supposed to be once a week, and sometimes he's 3 months late with an episode. 3 months, that's 12 episodes he misses. Right?
Yeah.
But when he just came out with the Grateful Dead episode, people's brains exploded. It wasn't 45 minutes long. It was 3.5 hours long. And it was, so you raise the expectations, you better deliver, right? Or Mystery Show, which is one of the four best podcasts ever recorded, she only made it to episode 6. But that's why I keep bringing up Mystery Show.
What is Mystery Show? I don't even know what that is.
Hold on 1 second. I'm going to put this on pause. So,
is that a gas or a...
A two-stroke gas leaf blower or weed whacker puts out as much damage to the climate as driving a pickup truck from here to California.
Yeah.
In one hour.
Yeah.
Think about that. This is a green building. They make a whole big deal out of it. And on a regular basis, the garden, right?
Yeah.
We'll give you one you can plug in. We'll give it to you.
Yeah.
And I bring it up and the building goes, ah. Okay.
We were talking about what was the podcast? Mystery Show? No.
Yes, Mystery Show.
Mystery Show. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So it was 10 years ago. I believe her name's Kylie Starr. And the thesis of the show is I will solve a mystery that cannot be solved on the internet. And the worst episode is How Tall is Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yeah.
And it involves her sort of stalking Jake and standing next to him.
Measuring
it.
Yeah.
But episode 3, which is the story about a belt buckle, is spectacular. And she was on this schedule to come out on a regular basis. But it turns out making a show as good as episode 3 was so difficult.
Impossible.
It was just taking longer and longer and longer. And finally, everyone said, we have to stop. But think about the magic of making Mystery Show. Think about what you have to do to create the conditions to record Kinda Blue. Kinda Blue was recorded in 4 days. If Miles had gone back and re-recorded to fix every off note, it wouldn't have been a better album. It would have been a worse album. So on one hand, we have a podcast that takes too long. On the other hand, we have an album that sold millions of copies that's magnificent in 4 days. What do they have in common? What they have in common is we have enough average work. We have to create the conditions for humanity to show up. That's what the Song of Significance is about. That you can be a cover band, a wedding band. You can be somebody who just, you know, plays Doobie Brothers in your basement. No one will notice if you disappear. This work, if we're going to bother doing it, isn't because we have a music shortage. It's because we have a magic shortage. And that is what we can learn from the bees. That is what we can learn as humans, which is create the conditions for magic. It's worth almost whatever it costs.
I think about this too at the same time by doing an episode of the podcast every week that maybe I am missing that little bit of extra work I could put into a single guest or an interview or a research or something, where if I did the podcast less frequently. But personally, I think if I did the podcast less frequently, I just wouldn't do it compared to knowing it has to be done every week. So how do you balance that? Because I actually think if I did less episodes, and maybe I should, that the podcast actually might be a little bit better because it might be well researched. But knowing my personality, I'm not convinced if I had 2 weeks to research for a guest, I would spend the 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I would probably spend the same amount of time researching and prepping.
It's funny you bring this up. The weirdest emails I get are from people who say, I don't have time to read all your blog posts. Would you please blog less? I'm like, just skip some. But the most offensive ones I get are, I think your blog would be better if you didn't blog as often.
Yeah.
As if there's like this finite amount of goodness.
Yeah.
And I write 5 blog posts a day. My blog would not get better because the ones that really work are the ones that I'm sure people aren't going to like. If I had to only do one a week, I would leave out those. But those are the ones that are the most beloved on my blog. So in your case, because there's a cadence, you're also able to say to yourself, I can put out something that doesn't rhyme with the 1, 3 that came before, because there's going to be plenty to choose from. That's whatever works for the creator is what you should do. But you're telling yourself, you need to raise the bar to say, what are the odds that this will be the best podcast of the year for me? And if you're not feeling that, at least a dozen times a year, then you might need to think about the structure of how you're approaching it. The same thing happens when an artist goes into the recording studio. If you're trying really hard to reverse engineer what's going to get you on the Billboard charts, if you're trying really hard to engineer what that program director is going to like, it's pretty unlikely that this is going to be the one. When you're doing the one that's going to be the one, I think what you're saying to yourself is, this is making me nervous. This is getting outside of other people's comfort zones. This is making me feel like an imposter. This is something that I might feel safer if I practiced it more. It's in those moments that our humanity shows up. So don't ship junk. Not allowed. But yeah, ship question marks. Question marks are totally worth it.
Yeah. Last year I did this thing where I was trying to go after a really big guest. I took out a billboard in the middle of Nashville and I booked the guest. So I said, okay, I want to do something like that again. There's a massive, massive producer that everyone always says I look like. So I did this thing. I have to show you these photos where I built a team of a set guy, a costume guy, a photographer, and we recreated photos of him. And we started posting them on social media saying, recreating photos of this person until they come onto my podcast. And I have to show you them because they're hilarious. We got to three, and a member of his team reached out to me and said, hey, the photos are funny, but he doesn't do podcasts. He's not going to come onto the show, and you should probably stop. And this haunts me, not because of the failure, but because I really feel like I let the team down, and I wanted to get that win for the team. And I also feel that every time I think about another stunt or another thing, I hesitate because in my head, and maybe this is fake, but in my head, I think that if I pull too many of these stunts and they don't work, it's going to be hard to continue to rally people to get excited behind them and to get behind me and to work on them with me. And I'm curious what you think about that. And, you know, you want to be able to not be fearful and to jump into another stunt or try something new. But I feel like if you have too many failures, the team doesn't want to rally behind you as quickly, especially if they're public like that.
Okay, so let's decode this a little bit. A stunt is an interesting word to use because often things that felt like a stunt in the moment ended up becoming impressive moments in world history, right? That Washington crossing the Delaware without any knowledge of American history probably could have been seen as a stunt, right? The Boston Tea Party was definitely a stunt. So I'm not sure I'm comfortable sorting things by whether they feel like a stunt in the moment. I think the question is the work generative? So what you were doing was trying to rally public attention to get on the radar of someone who could have declared a win by saying, I'll come on your show.
Yeah.
And they didn't. That doesn't mean the stunt failed. In fact, the stunt caused them to make a decision. However, it's not generative because you were doing it to this guy, not for this guy. And the real opportunity is to be seen as someone in your community who does unexpected things for other people. And then you can do that all you want because generosity is magical fuel.
That's where we went wrong, or that's what we should have done. We should have been more generous towards this producer.
But no, but you thought that maybe this producer was hesitating for other reasons. And it would have been generous because you're giving this person a platform to talk about their craft, right? That podcast guests don't get paid for a reason because podcast guests get a benefit. They get to pontificate with an interlocutor who is very helpful and helps them think things through. And they get to talk about their book or their record or whatever it is. That's generous. And so, you know, the people who hustle and hassle me, and I'm thinking about a couple now, authors who are, you know, trying to get promo or whatever. It never feels right if they're doing it for selfish reasons. It's when they do something generative, then everybody involved is glad that they were involved.
And how do you think you work with the team on anything you're doing where if you, let's say you do keep failing, or because that, what you're saying makes perfect sense, but it also feels like we didn't get it done as a team, even though that's not really true.
Well, but failing is, how many records does a musician have to sell before their A&R and promo team can say we didn't fail? Is it okay to hit the top 10?
Yeah.
Or is that still a failure because you didn't hit number one, right? Where are we going to draw this line of what it means to fail?
Yeah.
And in the case of your podcast, you're never going to have as many listeners as Marc Maron. You're just not. So does that mean the podcast is a failure? I don't think so. You pick your smallest viable audience and you say, how do I serve them? What do I bring them that they'll would have missed if I hadn't done it? And if you have a team that likes that process, then you're onto something.
Fair enough. Carbon Almanac, I just read recently too, which I loved. And I'm inspired by the way that you put it together, as I'm sure many people are. Can you replicate this in other areas? How do you actually motivate the team? I've heard you talk a lot about it. But was it, maybe it was the cause that was noble, maybe it was the Seth brand that was able to motivate the team. But if I wanted to do this to say write an almanac about the history of, you know, music in the 80s or whatever, could I assemble a team to do that generously and how would I do it?
Oh, well, I learned so much from this project. I did not write it. I did organize it. I founded it. 300, now 1900 people in 90 countries came together and created a 97,000 word almanac in 5 months ahead of schedule, with footnotes and graphs and charts and no errors. And no one got paid, including me. bestseller in lots of countries.
Who published it? Your publisher?
My publisher published it.
And so somebody, somehow someone's making money on it, right? Or who?
Oh, I hope they make a lot of money so they'll do it more.
Yeah.
Penguin paid us in advance. We used every penny to plant trees or to pay for software. And if it sells more than that, they'll send us a royalty check and we'll plant more trees. The thing about it is making it all volunteer simply made life easier for me and others because we didn't have to bring in the complicated discussion of money. But the reason it worked had very little to do with the climate and not that much to do with my brand name. It worked because I helped people get to where they were already going. That's all Wikipedia does, right? Wikipedia is the fourth biggest website in the world. Almost no one who works on it gets paid. But the people who work on it 40, 50, 60 hours a week do it because it's helping them get to where they want to go. So I didn't have to motivate anybody. I just had to establish the conditions for them to move in a direction that they were eager to do. And the people on the team, so many of them have said, this is the best thing I ever worked on in my whole life. This project established for me what I'm looking for going forward. That's why we all did it. I just had to find the right people.
And how'd you find the first batch?
Well, the first 20 people I hand invited because they were people I sort of knew. And then after that, I just wrote a blog post and said, fill out this form. And it only had 6 questions in it. And I looked for diversity of background and geography and everything else. And I invited them in and they came. And we had turnover. I love turnover. Turnover is a good thing because we said, look, this is what we're doing. This is how we're getting there. If this isn't for you, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
And so of the 1,900 people, perhaps 150 put in an enormous amount. I worked on it 60, 70, 80 hours a week, but so did some other people, right? Because that's enough. If you have to have everybody, then you have to bend over backwards to make sure everyone is doing this little thing that makes them. No, it's for someone. It's not for everyone.
And what happened on page 19?
So as we're building the book, I say to the group, look, this almanac's going to have a page 19. We know that 18, 17, all the numbers are going to be.
Could have been any page, yes, for this right analogy.
Page 19 had the right ring to it. In fact, page 19 is blank, but don't tell anyone because it ruins the story.
Ah.
So, and page 19 is going to need a topic and it's going to need graphs and charts. It's going to need research. It's going to need footnotes. And there is not one person here who knows how to do all of those things. So how are we going to get to page 19? Well, the answer is do a little bit and hand it to the group and say, please make this better. I have an idea for a topic. Oh, I can make that topic even better. I did some research. Here's a paragraph. Oh, I looked at your research. We could make this paragraph like this. Here's a chart. And this idea, put it in and say, I made this. Please make it better. That's what happens when a recording studio is working properly. That's what happens when a jazz quartet is trading fours. Is I just did, you know, Herbie Hancock's autobiography. It opens with him telling the story. He's 24 years old. He's on stage in Germany. Miles had just done Kind of Blue. He's a new member of the quartet. He wasn't on the album. And they're doing So What? So What is the big single. And he's got the piano solo that comes before Miles' trumpet solo. And he gets to the last measure and he hits a clunker of a note. He plays it wrong. And he's thrown it to Miles and he looks over and he's just bereft. He's screwed up on stage in the big moment. And Miles, in that moment, plays a completely different solo that makes the clunker sound perfect. And afterwards, Herbie comes to me and says, I'm so sorry, you're going to fire me. And I can't do a Miles invitation, but Miles says, don't worry about it. It's just a note and I had to do with it.
Where's that story from, or where's that?
It's in the first chapter of Herbie Hancock's autobiography.
Got it.
Called, I think, Milestones. And that's how you begin to understand Miles and jazz and the whole interaction. Page 19 thinking, here, I made this for you, Miles. And Miles said, oh, I got it. What am I going to do with this? And he didn't stop, put down the trumpet and say, you're fired. He played something new.
Yeah.
He made something better.
I want to try doing it. To me, this is the craziest thing ever. Like, could you pull this off again? Like, could I go out and try to do this
for sure.
Pick a topic and
it's happening all the time.
It's happening all the time.
Usually happens with software.
Yeah.
Which means it leaves out people who have decided they don't know how to code. But if you wanted to write, you know, history of bluegrass from Bill Monroe to this person.
Yeah.
I think 10 people could live in discourse and pull that off in 4 weeks. It would be really thrilling to see. You'd have to find people who are strong opinions, loosely held, and who are willing to exchange back and forth with each other to produce something of value.
I'm into the almanac idea. Why not?
Yeah.
I loved your blog post this morning about placebo effects with Leland Sklaw, who he posted this hilarious video where he's got his bass and he goes, "This is the producer switch." And he switches it. He says, "Whenever a producer asks for a different tone, I flip the switch. I make sure they see it, and I play exactly what I'm playing." And that always the producers always love that. You also did a great podcast and a great episode of your podcast, Akimbo, where you talk about placebo effects and the nocebo effect. What are we getting right about placebo effects? What are we getting wrong? And how do we incorporate them into our lives?
Oh, I love this question. Okay. Placebos get no respect for a reason I cannot understand. People say it's just a placebo. You should go see a real doctor.
Yeah.
We know plenty of studies, most of them done at Harvard, but peer-reviewed studies, we know that for many physical ailments, 33 to 70% of our ability to get better is the placebo effect in our head. For example, if you have a certain kind of knee surgery, the odds are that your knee will get better just as well if they do fake knee surgery, put you under, cut you, and don't touch anything. Just cut your skin and stitch you up. We know that for back pain, acupuncture is the number one most effective way to cure back pain most of the time, except when we think about number two, which is fake acupuncture done by someone who doesn't understand how to do acupuncture, just randomly pokes you with needles. We know that if your brain believes you're going to get better in whatever area it is, physical fitness, being a musician, it is much more likely you will get better. So where do we go with that? If you want to develop a better practice, figuring out how to find placebos that work for you and create the conditions for them to work, like this office we're sitting in, it exists so that when I walk in here, I feel different. It's a placebo. It makes my work better. A nocebo is a placebo that makes us worse. And we are surrounded by nocebos. We're surrounded by inputs that end up ruining our day, inputs that end up putting us into a downward spiral. And so if you're a creator, if you're someone who's doing a certain kind of work, or you want your health to get better, figure out where the nocebos are and get rid of them. Because, and that's, for example, why walking works so well for physical fitness. If you go for a long walk around the block every morning, your affect, your health will improve. A tiny piece of it is cardiovascular, and most of it is you're reprogramming your brain out of a downward cycle into an upward cycle.
That's the walk is mostly placebo?
Yeah, which is a great thing. Placebos are magical. You can't overdose on them. They're really cheap and they're effective.
How do you use that with your team, though? Is it speaking positively, or is it saying that if your team meets once a week for coffee or whatever, that that's going to improve the team? Or like, how do you think about that when you're building
an organization? So if I think about the creative industries, a huge placebo, unfortunately, is an asshole boss who makes a big commotion all the time, lives large, does all these things, and suddenly they have hit records. What did they do that led to hit records, right? Why were the mafiosos so good at making hit records in the 60s? Part of it is because, you know, they controlled the Teamsters and everything else. But part of it is because that's a placebo, which is I need to lean outside of where I am because in my head, something else, blah, 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 even though there's no direct correlation between the two. When we think about what makes a team work, it's not the stopwatch. It's not that better do this or you'll get fired, because that's factory work and that's not going to get you better creative output. Maybe you're going to build a team where the placebo, and we know this from something called the Hawthorne effect. General Electric, Hawthorne, New York, right down the street from us, had a factory where they were making something, and an MBA shows up and he turns up the lights a little bit, just a few watts, and productivity goes up. And a week later, they turn the lights up a little bit more and productivity goes up. And a week later, they turn up the lights a little bit more and productivity goes up. And the next week, someone messes up and turns the lights down and productivity goes up. Because what made productivity go up were subconsciously people thinking someone was watching, not the number of lumens that were being broadcast. We know that if people are stealing from the coffee jar, that where you're supposed to put a dollar when you take a donut, if you put up a picture, just a picture on the wall of two eyeballs, looking at people, theft will go down. It's a placebo effect.
I'm all about it. I'm here for it. We're wrapping up because I know we have limited time. We were just talking about the Grateful Dead, who Dead & Company just played their last concert a couple weeks ago, or maybe last week. You see this all the time, how you'll see these bands that have these key members who will die or quit and the band can continue. And then other times, like in the case of Jerry Garcia, and then other times, you know, the lead person dies or even the drummer dies in the case of Led Zeppelin and the band ends. If you're thinking about an organization or anything and how to make it bigger than yourself, or if you're thinking about a band or an artist, what can you do in the case of the Grateful Dead to ensure that it was going to live beyond Jerry?
We need to have a different name for the Grateful Dead after Jerry, because the Grateful Dead with Jerry was one thing. After Jerry, it was a different thing. The Grateful Dead is a religion in the best possible sense. It has a sacrament, it has scripture, it has method, it has culture, it has deacons, it has everything. The religion persisted, just like every religion that's around today. Its prophets died a long time ago, because religions are about the people who are worshiping, not about the people who are being worshiped. And Led Zeppelin, while it has a cadre of people who are very aligned with it, never rose to the level of being a religion the way the Grateful Dead is. And so something else came along that those fans could listen to that was new. And so religions, secular religions, are pretty rare in our culture, but they're magical when they appear. Apple is one for sure, right? So Steve leaves, Tim changes the mission of the company to let's increase shareholder value by making a luxury good for rich people as opposed to let's innovate. Hasn't had one significant innovation in years, but the religion persists because the people who were part of it all along want it to still be there. And so I think sometimes it's intentional. There are certainly groups that aren't giant groups that have built this, where you come because the other people are there. You listen because the other people are listening. But there are other groups that reach a level of cultural resonance that we need them to stick around. I know that if I start playing a Joni Mitchell song from 40 years ago, I'll get all weepy because she reminds me of who I was then. And the music will outlive Joni. But it's on the edge of being a religion because I can listen to Joni by myself. It's harder to listen to the Grateful Dead by yourself.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, we're wrapping up. Last time I asked you on the show for a key gadget and a key ingredient, and you gave me some great ideas. I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to throw this back at you again for a key gadget, toy, thing. And a key ingredient could be a food, could be a brand or a company that we need to go look at.
Right. Okay, so the key gadget, you're sitting there looking at it right now. It's the 2A3, 3-watt per channel, 70-year-old tube amp.
Is that this one over here?
Yes.
And you made the speakers. Is there a placebo effect in how good they sound?
You listened to them.
They sound great, but I knew you made them. Maybe that had the placebo effect built in.
So the 2A3 amplifier, which is from the 50s, is not expensive from a stereo point of view, should be the dominant way that people listen to music, who care about how music sounds. The only reason it's not is transistors became really cheap, and transistor amps could power a inefficient speaker and sounded bad with efficient speakers. So we then invented more and more inefficient speakers, and you can't listen to a great amp with inefficient speakers because it doesn't have the oomph. So you have to change some things in your place. But if you're into music, you will thank me. A 2A3, go to Hi-Fi Shark, and you can find plenty for sale for $800. $1,200.
Both the tube amp, is that what we're talking about, the preamp or the tube?
The tube is a whole separate thing. The preamp is a separate thing. I'm talking about those two matching mono tube amps.
That's what you're going to want. But then those are the tube amps. Then what do you need? A receiver, and then you're good?
Yeah, and then you just need really efficient speakers, which are not that hard to find if you look for them.
Great gadget.
Okay.
Great tip. Okay, moving on.
And then an ingredient. If you haven't made dosa, I really want to give a strong pitch for dosa.
Let's go. Let's pitch.
Go to the Indian market. There's one near you. And dosa mix is sold $5 for a container that can make 40 dosa. And you just stir it up and you put it into a flat frying pan. You fry it with just a little Pam each side for a minute and a half, and you'll get this crispy, giant pancake that's half lentils, half rice. It's a perfect protein. It's the only food you need to eat, and it's just delicious.
Oh my God, I'm going to do that.
You can come to my house for dosa.
Done. I'll see you there. Seth, the book, The Song of Significance. This is a manifesto for teams. I loved it.
You're very kind.
Your books are always, they feel like they're a progression. Like it feels like after reading The Practice and now it's like you read The Song of Significance, feels like they all go together. This is marketing leads into The Practice. I don't know if that's intentional, but maybe it's just the way you progress as a writer, but they feel like they're all part of a collection. And this one was really special and it's given me a lot of thought. Then I never thought I would think so much about the bees or read a book by Jacqueline Freeman about the bees, but now I'm in it and I'm really into it. It's all about the bees.
Amazing.
So thank you for taking time for round two. And
on video this time.
On video this time. We're moving in the right direction. And in person. We were virtual last time.
Yeah.
We did. Big shout out to Melrose Podcasts, by the way. I keep thinking I might give them shout outs. They'll give me a deal. I don't think they have yet. I've been saying that for many episodes now. Yeah. That's it. We did. Seth, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you both. You're so good.